Chip Fulghum is the chief financial officer at the Department of Homeland Security and DHS, currently operating under a continuing resolution until the end of February. Chip, thank you very much for your time today. How is that continuing resolution affecting operations day to day at the Homeland Security Department? Thanks for your time, Chip.
So, and thanks for having me. So, from that perspective, you know, what a CR does to us is, I like to describe it in these simple terms, that under a CR, the Congress gives us a little bucket of money. They give us little buckets of money to operate under, and we really don't know how much money is going to be in that bucket until we get it. And then Congress then restricts how much you can take out of that bucket each day. So that is clearly not the optimal way to run a department. And what it basically does is it creates what I call budget paralysis. So rather than have budget certainty, which the annual appropriation would provide, and by the way, the bill that was introduced in the House by Chairman Carter, the clean version of the appropriations bill, which had bipartisan support, is a good bill for DHS, and as a standalone bill is something that we would certainly support. But what CRs do in basic terms is they disrupt our day-to-day operations because of that uncertainty about how much is in each bucket and the constraints. They're administratively burdensome, and what I mean by that is because we don't have an annual funding amount, we have to incrementally fund a lot of our contract efforts, which puts an increased workload on an already strained contracting workforce. It delays our hiring. So there are things, items in the budget for additional HSI agents, for example. In fact, we were just talking yesterday to the House staff about, hey, you're going to be able to get these HSI agents on board, and we had to remind them, well, you know, we're unable to do that right now because of the budget uncertainty that's created by CRs. It can potentially disrupt our acquisition programs. And then, as you know, they're under a CR, we're not allowed to do any new starts or new initiatives. So there are things that we need to do in FY15 that we're just not able to do under a CR, and let me give you a couple of examples.
Sure.
As you know, the Secret Service recently had an independent panel review the security and the agency as a whole and made some recommendations about things that we need to do to enhance security and enhance the posture of the United States Secret Service. So we're not allowed to go forward and do those things because we need additional resources to do that. In addition to that, the FY16 campaign, the presidential campaign, is rolling out. And typically when we have a campaign, we have to increase the amount of money we put into our infrastructure. In other words, there's additional vehicle items we need to do to vehicles, as well as hire additional personnel. We're not able to do that, as well as we have to begin planning for a former Obama detail, and we're just not able to hire those folks. There are things we want to do on the border. There's money in the current bill for increased dollars for technology on the border that we're not able to do. So, I mean, those are just a couple of things that we're not able to do under a CR. And what I would tell you is the other thing that operating under a CR is we're right now planning on three different scenarios. So under one scenario, we get a clean bill, which is obviously the positive outcome we would like to see. But now we have to plan for either another short-term CR or a long-term CR, and each has its own set of challenges, some of which we've already talked about. And then the final thing is we have to be prepared that if Congress is unable to provide one of the other two items I just listed, we have to do some type of shutdown preparation. And all of those things are disruptive to the department. We could talk about, if you'd like, what happens under a shutdown for DHS, but we do have to plan for that, even though we remain hopeful that Congress will either pass another short-term CR while they work out how to get us an annual appropriation or pass that clean bill.
I would very much like to talk about what a shutdown might look like at DHS, because we've seen any number of news reports in the past couple of weeks about what that scenario would look like that ranges anywhere from extremely problematic to, well, it wouldn't affect the agency agency that much, but none of the source material seemed to come directly from DHS. So your insight as to what it would look like from inside the agency would be very instructive, Chip.
Okay, so under a CR, I think what you've heard the top line is that about 85% of the workforce would come to work. So that's your frontline law enforcement personnel, your military personnel, all those folks that are deemed to be essential or accepted, depending on the vernacular you want to use, in terms of health, life, and safety, and those type things. So on the surface, it says, okay, 85% is going to come to work. But there are 30,000 people who won't come to work. And even those who do come to work would not be paid. So that's the military personnel, as well as your TSOs, your Border Patrol agents, your investigative force at ICE, your Secret Service agents, both uniform division and agents. They would not be paid. In addition to that, it's the 30,000 folks that would not come to work. Those are the people who pay people. So no one would get paid, and that includes contractors. Some contractors, depending on how the contract is structured, would be sent home. We would do no new hiring. We would stop work on acquisitions, we would have to pretty much stop work on current grants, as well as not issuing any new grants. So whether we're under a CR or a shutdown in the case of grants, we're not able to do, they're considered new starts. So in either case, we would not be able to issue new grants, which has a significant impact on every state, every local major municipality throughout the nation. So in addition to that, under a shutdown, DHS would shut down all its training. We would shut down the law enforcement training at FLETC. We would shut down our airport screener training, and as well as proficiency training that goes on throughout non-law enforcement proficiency training that goes on throughout the department. So while it sounds, you know, like, hey, business as usual, you have a lost opportunity cost, you clearly have a loss in productivity, as well as the overtime that's required when we would come back to work for all those people to get those bills paid, get contracts started back again, get hiring started back up again. So it would clearly be disruptive to the department. And the final thing I would say is just the appearance that DHS has been sent home is probably not something that we would want to show or be a message to anyone around the world who would want to do potential harm to the nation.
Chip, a number of members of Congress, but not a huge number, unfortunately, have expressed an interest in trying to quantify what it's cost the government to go through these various shutdown scenarios and planning and all of this stuff that we've gone through over the past several years. In your view as a CFO of the agency, is that knowable? Is that quantifiable? Or is too much of it open to supposition that we could never even really know the impact? It just strikes me that knowing that number would be useful for members on the Hill to be able to say, well, it's not really worth it to go through this again because it's going to cost us X number of dollars just to go through the shenanigans.
Yeah, I think clearly there is some aspect that's quantifiable in terms of lost productivity. So if you take 30,000 employees that aren't coming to work, you can do some very basic math to get to some, okay, here's the lost productivity cost of for however long it was. But there's a lot of variability to it, too, in terms of it depends on how long you're shut down, right? If you're shut down for a day, you know, you could talk about the lost productivity, but the impact on contracts and hiring and those things and grant making and those type activities are much different than if it's a prolonged shutdown. So I do think there's some variability, but I think the bottom line is, again, that it is extremely disruptive. And there's one other aspect to it that I want to make very clear, which is that, you know, one of the things we hear about and you hear about is the morale of this department. When you have a cloud of uncertainty over this department, that is not helpful for morale of the frontline personnel in this agency. And so that just contributes to it. And, you know, this department is working very hard. The secretary and the deputy are both extremely engaged, as well as the component leadership all the way on down, into improving morale in the department. And so when things like this occur, there's that non-quantifiable impact of things like morale.
That you anticipated where I wanted to go next as we wrap up the conversation about the planning for the shutdown, which is what's the impact that you've seen, as you have obviously not been making these plans in a vacuum. You've been discussing them with your leadership team, and they've been then discussing them with their teams, and so on down the line. I imagine there's a sense around the agency of how this has impacted morale, which, as you say, is something that's considered a work in progress at DHS.
Well, I think, first of all, we're blessed to have a dedicated workforce that's committed to performing the vital mission of this department. So, and their primary focus is the mission that they go out and perform each and every day. But when you're in the hallways and you're talking to various people, it invariably comes up because, you know, but as you know, before in 2013, as we approached the shutdown, most folks thought we would get to the end and we would go, okay, they'll reach an agreement and we'll move forward. That didn't occur. So while we continue to say tell our folks we remain hopeful that we'll get an appropriation or a continuation of funding while they work out an appropriation bill, it does have some impact because you hear it, throughout your ongoing walking around, if you will, in the hallways.
Chip Fulgham is the Chief Financial Officer at the Department of Homeland Security. Let's switch gears for a little bit, if we can, please, and talk about your successful audit. It's quite an achievement. How did you get to where you are with the audit opinion and the audit situation, Chip?
So, first of all, we are very proud of our achievement. 2 years running now. We are on the second year of a clean opinion. And, you know, when you go back and look at it, in fact, some folks from the Navy came over the other day and were talking and wanted to pick our brain about, okay, how'd you do it? You really get to, at the strategic level, four or five key things. The first thing that the department did was they put the right people in place. You know, we hired dedicated, talented people, not only at the department, but in the components. So, I mean, the first and foremost is you've got to have a dedicated, talented workforce, and we continue to be blessed to have that. The second thing is you need the right leadership. So you need, you know, audits, as you know, aren't a sexy topic, but you've got to have leadership focus. And this department has had consistent leadership focus and support for the past 6 or 7 years, for sure, since we first started really talking about this in the 2007-2008 time frame. We have had dedicated leadership focus and support, which I think is critical. So that just cascades down to the components, as well as another critical aspect, which is the other lines of business. So, you know, everybody thinks audits are a CFO thing, but you need the right procurement system interfaces, as well as, you know, the right information coming from property and asset management systems. So when you look, and as well as human capital systems, so all those things feed into the financial system. So you've got to have the buy-in of my fellow lines of business, and we've had tremendous support. And I think a lot of that is due to the fact that this department has an undersecretary for management, which has all of those lines of business I just talked about underneath them. So it was much easier for us to corral and get that unity of effort. And then the next thing, you need a strategy. I mean, we sat down in 2008, and the folks that were here at the time, Peggy Sherry and others, sat down, and David Norquist sat down and said, we need a strategy here. And so we decided we need to take a bite at the apple, one bite at a time. So we started with the balance sheet. We got that straightened out, and then we continued down because we thought the balance sheet was critical because it's sort of the hub, right? Once you get it right, it sort of feeds into the other statements. And then the last thing I would say is we had a sustained focus. and we had innovative solutions. So you'll hear a lot about, DHS has had to do a lot of workarounds, a lot of manual processes. I would say that's partly the answer, but I would also say we had a lot of innovative out-of-the-box solutions. We partnered with the auditor. You know, I look at the auditor as they're the teacher, and, you know, you're sort of the student. But we continue to work with them to go, hey, we've run up against this wall. You know, can you give us a couple of ideas about how you think we should solve it? Now, we're not looking for you to solve the problem for you, but, you know, engaging them, I think, was critical. And then we built sound policy and procedures, you know, the nuts and bolts of how you do your operation, especially from an internal control perspective. We built those sound policies and repeatable business processes. So all of that put together with a lot of hard work from a lot of folks, and got us a clean opinion last year, and we repeat it again this year.
We'll talk about the progression of that in just a moment, but okay. I imagine there were sticking points at some point. It can't have been as perfect as you made it sound, Chip. Where were some of the points of dissonance, not specific agencies or whatever, but process issues that you ran into that maybe you didn't anticipate or that were harder to resolve than you expected? I'm thinking of this from a lessons learned perspective, more from a pointing the finger perspective.
No, absolutely. So, as you know, when DHS was formed, we had 22 agencies that came together. They all came with their own financial systems, and some were in better shape than others. When the department was formed, we also inherited 18 material weaknesses, and that basically means that when you look at those business processes, the internal controls aren't in place so that you can say, yep, that's a good, repeatable, sound process. So, I mean, one of the biggest sticking points was we had to overcome those. So, again, the first step in overcoming a internal control issue is to build basic building blocks, sound processes and procedures that can be repeated. So we've whittled those 18 down to 4. From a financial system perspective, we had to go say, okay, we're not going to be able to modernize our systems as fast as we want. So how can we get to a clean opinion with what we have? And so, again, you had to go and say, what is an acceptable workaround to get to the point that we want to get at? But I would say those two things, you know, when we started, you had 18 material weaknesses, and you're like, how are we ever going to overcome those? We just started knocking them out one at a time, and we're down to 4. As an aside, and I think we may talk about this later, you know, we are the only department that is required by law to get a clean opinion on our internal controls over financial reporting. So, you know, that is, to me, is a good thing because it drives us to be even better, and we believe that we're on a path to be the gold standard for the federal government, and not only in getting a clean opinion and sustaining it, but getting that internal control opinion as well.
Chip Fulgham's the Chief Financial Officer at the Department of Homeland Security, and anybody in the federal financial community or anybody that follows it knows that the Department of Defense and the individual components of DOD are on this same journey that you're on. You mentioned a few minutes ago, Chip, that some folks from the Navy came to visit you, and I find that interesting because, as I said, you know, they feel the pressure of a deadline coming, and I'm curious to know what they saw that you were doing that they wanted to know more about. That's a terrific endorsement, I think, given the pressure that they're under, that they said there's obviously something that we could learn from DHS.
Yeah, I think they walked away with, hey, you know, they felt good that they're on the right path, that they've got a sound strategy, And we just kept hammering home the point about it is about you've got to have leadership buy-in. So, you know, our deputy secretary, every month we sit down with our deputy secretary and talk to him about how we're making progress on internal controls over financial reporting. So when you have that engagement from the top and that buy-in from the top, that's critical. We shared with them our internal control remediation program, where every month we get the CFOs from every agency within DHS around the table and go, how are you doing and making progress? What are the sticking points? How can the headquarters help you? And then that cascades right back out to the components. So I think the biggest takeaway from them was the incredible buy-in from a leadership perspective on helping us continue to not only sustain that clean audit, but helping us get that clean audit over internal controls as well. And so the components, and I've been to the these internal control meetings, and you know, again, they're non-sexy topics, but I've sat with the Vice Commandant of the Coast Guard and all of his direct reports, and they go through and say, how are we going to make progress? And when there's an issue, invariably, it's not he's not looking at the eight or the controller. He's talking to his chief CIO, or he's talking to his logistics guy and saying, okay, they need some help. How do we fix that? So when you have that kind of buy-in, and that's just one example, I could go around the department and give you others. I mean, that's critical. That is the key to making this happen. And so I think that reinforced their belief and need in making sure that they keep their leadership engaged.
Chip, an old friend of mine told me once very early in my career, if you do something well, they'll make you do it again. Now, you've got two in a row under your belt. How do you maintain that streak and avoid backsliding?
So I think, first of all, you know, I'm a big sports guy and I'm a big football guy. And so, you know, Lou Holtz, I read a book that Lou wrote, and he talked about after winning the national championship at Notre Dame, they talked about, hey, we just want to maintain. You know, we just want to maintain. And as you know, or may know, Notre Dame's never won another national title. Mm-hmm. And he said the biggest mistake he made was we should have said we want to get better. So what I challenged our guys with after the first clean opinion was, we're not going to rest here. We're just going to continue to get better. And if we continue to improve our processes, we continue to whittle down those material weaknesses, we continue to strive forward to be innovative in our approach, we won't have to worry about the clean opinion. Because as we continue to get better each day, it will happen. And we carried that approach through the FY14 cycle. And by and large, it was an uneventful audit. And that's the other part. We're trying to get to a place where we want to operationalize the audit to where it is a normal routine back shop function. And so that again, is about continuing to get better, standardizing your business processes, and whittling down those material weaknesses and getting the proper controls in place and testing in place and all those technical aspects of internal controls that you can show the auditor, I've got policy processes, I've got testing in place, here's what I found, I fixed it, I documented it, now you can go test it, and I can tell you right now that you're not going to find anything.
Chip, final thought on the audit issues. You alluded earlier to the GAO's concern about some manual workarounds, and you called them an innovative solution. They are worried about those. Why aren't you?
Well, we've done it 2 years in a row. I believe when you really get in there and look at it, we've got solid processes in place that – where we need a quote-unquote workaround, we have them, and we just got to stay focused on it. So that all goes back to the technical aspects of internal controls, right? So you've got to go in and periodically test your key controls, your key business processes, to make sure that you're still on solid ground with the proper remediation of whatever workaround you needed. And so it's just about staying focused. We use those meetings that we have with the CFOs every month to go, okay, continuing to hold our own here and make progress here in other areas. And so I stay focused on it, I'm not worried that we're going to have any backsliding whatsoever.
Chip Fulghum's the Chief Financial Officer at the Homeland Security Department. We'll change gears again for just a moment. One of your former colleagues, Chip, Rafael Boris, told us about a year or so ago about the launch of the Management Cube. And I'm curious about the progress of that and how it is helping you use data to make decisions better inside the agency.
So, yes, I call Rafael the father of the Management Cube. And it is the perfect thing for this department. So what the department has lacked and we're making progress on is the vision of timely information. So the whole financial systems modernization effort to go to the best in either the federal or the commercial sector and use those state-of-the-market systems are only get us to a point. What we then need is business intelligence to pull that information from various systems into one place, one repository where we have timely, accurate information. So that's financial. What the Management Cube does for us is it pulls not only financial information, it pulls hiring information, it pulls security access information. In other words, how often are people going in and out of buildings? We have real property information, so we know where the buildings are. And so the Management Cube pulls all that together and gives you one holistic picture of the department from a personnel standpoint, from a infrastructure standpoint, from a financial standpoint, as well as we can understand how people are coming and going. And that's important from a building use standpoint, right? So, you know, if we know folks are in and out of particular facilities, that helps us understand how can we get more efficient in the use of those facilities. So we pull all that together, and we have a very small, dedicated team working continue that effort, so that now what we're trying to do is refine it, get it to the next level down. So from a financial perspective right now, we can look at it at a macro level. We'd like to get to the next level of detail. So we're on a path to do that. In fact, yesterday, the Management Cube was one of 8 finalists at ACT IAC's Igniting Innovation Award. So we're very excited about it. In terms of what it brings to us from not only human capital and contracting, asset security, but a financial management perspective as well.
With 20-some components involved in the agency and providing information and so on, do you have a consistent level of contributions to that data that you talked about that the Cube kind of turns on? And do you have a consistent level of uses of the information? What I'm getting at is I wonder how comfortable people are making decisions within one component based on information from the others.
Yeah, so as you know, anytime you've got data sharing going on, there's always some concern about, you know, what are you going to use it for? Are you sure you know what you're looking at? So I would say that we're in our infancy in terms of the analytical capabilities that it will provide. But again, one of the things we're blessed with is the Undersecretary for Management has all those lines of business. So he owns the contracting function, he owns the personnel function, he owns the financial management function, he owns the security function, he owns the property function. So from that perspective, we're able to all get on the same page under the leadership of the USM to further our goals. But I would say that we still have a lot of change management to do. You know, if you build it, they will come. We've now built it. Now we've got a lot of work to do to get our folks on the system, using the system, making the system more user-friendly, expanding its capability in terms of what types of information you can pull from it, et cetera.
But it sounds like that's cultural, and I'm certainly not minimizing the importance of that, but it sounds like you've kind of knocked out the technical part of it, and it is just a matter of making sure that it's as robust as possible data-wise because people are feeding it, and then because they're turning around and using it also. Am I correct? There?
Yeah, I mean, we're confident in the quality of the data coming in. You know, we'd like it to be more robust in terms of its, you know, timeliness. But, you know, that's, again, largely a financial systems issue that, you know, we are continuing to make progress on. But, yeah, the simple answer to your question is yes.
Chip, I just wonder if there are other things that people should know about the way that you're using data to make decisions inside the agency, just because that's something that every agency seems to be maybe in the second or third inning of figuring out. The agencies have, a pretty good sense of what they're collecting and how to organize it, how to collate it, and now what do we do with it? How do we apply it seems to be the question that a lot of people are asking. How are you trying to pose that question and answer it at DHS?
So a couple ways. I mean, one of the reasons the Management Cube was born was because this agency, like many, did lots of data calls. I mean, whenever we wanted to know something about personnel, we had to go ask someone. Whenever we wanted to know about some financial information, we invariably would have to go ask contracting information, and the list goes on and on. So, I mean, one of the biggest benefits from a practical standpoint is those data calls have significantly diminished. But to your broader question, I mean, I think we're on the cusp of being able to unleash our analysts so that they're able to explore trends, they're able to look at relationships between the various information that's in there and a correlation of that data across people, assets, funding, as well as, you know, your investment and contracting information. So then they can, you know, develop their own types of modeling and predictive analytical tools. I mean, so that we're able to answer the what-if question. So what if, you know, we do something to hiring over here? What are the implications and things of that nature? So I think the biggest thing is helping us to do is get us into more of a predictive capability. And by the way, let me share that we have demonstrated the Management Cube to not only the Chief Financial Officers Council government-wide, but we've also been to other councils as well. So we've been to the Human Capital Council. I think we've been to the Procurement Council. So, you know, we are trying to spread the word that, hey, we believe we're onto something here, that this is a best practice, and we're happy to share it and let other folks leverage it as well.